This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. How would we make it through this cold pandemic winter if not for movies, TV, and music? We're showing our thanks with the 1A Hit List. It's our monthly roundup of the best in entertainment. We'll talk about the new films that are Oscar frontrunners like Judas and the Black Messiah and Nomadland, and throw in a sleeper hit that's generating more and more buzz, the TV show Ted Lasso. We'll be getting even more recommendations from Caroline Framke. She's the chief TV critic at Variety. Caroline, it's great to have you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Also with us is Anne Hornaday, movie critic at The Washington Post. Hi, Anne. Welcome back.
Hello. Thank you so much.
And Stephen Thompson from NPR Music and the Pop Culture Happy Hour. Hey, Stephen.
Hi, Jen. It's great to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
We also want to hear from you. What have you been watching lately? You can comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or send us an email at 1A@wamu.org. And it doesn't have to be new. It could be an old favorite that you're reaching back to for nostalgic reasons. That's cool, too. So, Caroline, most of the country is still experiencing frigid temperatures, but not Florida, where it's in the high 70s. And that's where two main characters go in the new movie Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar.
It's this tiny little oasis on the coast of Florida. It's people like us, midlifers, who still like to strut past the pool and stop the party dead in its tracks with a tube top and full jewelry.
Wow.
I'm not kidding. I feel like I got a soul douche. There are so many gorgeous men there. We're talking Tommy Bahama from head to toe.
Tommy Bahama.
I'll drop off a brochure later.
Oh, wow. Oh, thank you.
Well, I mean, it won't be necessary.
I mean, yeah, but it'd be nice to just see what it looks like. But what's the name of the place again?
Vista Del Mar.
Okay, so Barb and Star are played by Annie Mumolo and Kristen Wiig, who also wrote the film. Caroline, what else should we know about this movie?
Well, I have to say this one took me by surprise. I hadn't heard much about it and then saw increasingly a lot of excited chatter sort of on my timeline, so figured I'd check it out. And something to know about this one is that unlike some of the other films that have come out during the pandemic, this one is only available to rent. So I happily paid the $20 for it and watched this movie, which is so much weirder than I can possibly describe to you. About 3 minutes in, I realized that I had no idea what this movie was truly about. But without spoiling anything, it's about these two middle-aged Midwestern women who decide once they get laid off to take a vacation, and they stumble into such a stranger situation than they could have ever anticipated. But Kristen Wiig and Annie Mumolo have worked together and written together for a long time. They wrote Bridesmaids, which, if you can believe it, came out 10 years ago this year. and they know what they're doing, and they're so funny. And it just seems to me to be destined to be the kind of cult comedy that's, you know, someone stumbles upon years from now, and it's like a Wet Hot American Summer thing where it just feels like it was made for you, that kind of thing.
And what about you? Yeah. You saw the film too, right?
Yeah, you know, I mean, one of the aspects of us all being so cooped up is we just want to escape, right? I mean, we just want to laugh, and that's all it does. It just makes us laugh. It's completely unhinged, as Caroline says. It's impossible to describe or synopsize. It's uneven. I can't defend it as great art, but I can defend it as what a lot of people feel like they need right now. And Caroline's also right about Kristen Wiig and Annie Mumolo. I mean, they have such a great chemistry, and they've been doing this for so long that it's just a showcase to watch them work. And there are just some completely bizarre non sequiturs that will either, you know, flummox you or delight you, depending on your emotional needs at the moment.
Caroline, I'm curious because this movie was originally meant to have a theatrical release, but as you said, it was released on demand instead. I mean, is it different? Because I remember seeing Bridesmaids with my girlfriends and just having this really raucous time in the theater. Is it different? Does it lose anything? Were you just watching it at home by yourself?
Yes and no. I mean, you know, on the one hand, I kind of miss the forced concentration of being in a theater. You know, I did end up pausing it a couple times to fix dinner or do that and the other thing. And that's a little strange as far as a theatrical experience. But it also feels like the kind of movie I would love to rent. You know, like, it just felt like that level of film. I didn't feel like I missed out so much on seeing it on a big screen. Certainly the group aspect of it I missed. But I was also something, like I said, I was happy to pay the money for it because I feel like this is the kind of movie that doesn't get made as much anymore, that will struggle the most in a year like this. You know, people will pay to see Wonder Woman or Mulan, but I feel like something like this, Barb and Star, needs the encouragement. And if studios know that people will pay for this going forward, that's something I wanted to help them with.
Now, Stephen, you wanted to recommend to us the Hulu special In and of Itself.
Every secret has a unique weight to it, and you can only carry them for so long.
You think this is a performance? You see a man in a theater, there's an audience. It is difficult to see past what this looks like.
Now, In and of Itself stars Derek Delgadio, and this is a pretty unusual film. How would you describe it?
It's really tricky to describe. I mean, it is part theater, it's part one-man show, it's part magic show. This is actually recorded over the course of a bunch of nights at a theater in New York back when we were able to do live theater. And it is really hard to explain. I mean, yes, it's a magic show, but it is also this deeply humanistic reflection on identity. It triggers a lot of introspection. It involves a lot of audience interaction. And I found watching it at home, you just have to give yourself over to it. And it is a magic show. You have several moments where you actually are like, how on earth did he do that? And I was just so taken with how moving it was and how much it kind of just like triggered kind of these warm, deep thoughts about self in a way that I didn't expect from a magic show on Hulu.
I'm trying to wrap my head around this one because I haven't seen it. Is it performed in front of a live audience?
Yes, it's performed in front of a live audience, and not to spoil anything, but it actually incorporates the audience in very moving ways. If you are a sympathetic crier, if you are somebody who watches other people cry, you will find yourself just flooding over the course of this show. And it is hard to explain. It's one of these things where I've like texted friends and said, please just go to Hulu and spend 90 minutes and watch this. But I can do that with friends. I can't necessarily do that with radio listeners who aren't going to necessarily take my word for it and give up 90 minutes of their one wild and precious life to check it out. But I just found this show to be so beautiful.
All right, Anne, what about you? What was your take on In and of Itself?
Well, as a sympathetic crier, I want to tell Stephen I feel seen, so thank you. And I totally agree. I think one of the curious powers of this film and the performance that it captures is that Derek Delgadio, the performance artist, and I think that's what I would call him, he continually subverts performance. There are silences. There are what I would call kind of awkward silences. He's not slick. He's not a showman. And I think that's part of the design of what he wants to do, is to sort of subvert the spectacle of magic and use it more, as Stephen said, as a form of inquiry into identity and also other. You know, I mean, it's really about this kind of communal experience. And the concluding sequence is one of the most moving things I've seen this year. I mean, it's just, it's so powerful. But Stephen's also right that you really do need to be prepared for it, and kind of it's something you really have to sit with. You have to sit with while you're watching it and give yourself some space to sit with how you feel as you're coming out of it.
Is this something you would call family friendly?
Yeah, I think it, you know, everybody knows their family and their children, and there's a little bit of coarse language, and I think that the concepts are heady. You know, it's a cerebral experience, but it's about connection for me. Ultimately, it really was about connection. So yeah, I think that depending on your family and their kind of tolerance for art and inquiry and strong emotional experiences, I think it could be a really powerful family experience.
And just make sure to have the Kleenex handy. I want to talk about a bit of new music. Tash Sultana is a gender-fluid 25-year-old musician from Australia. They released their sophomore album, Terra Firma, on Friday, and we'll hear a bit of it in just a moment. But first, Stephen, what's special about their sound?
Well, I think part of what's special about their sound is how much it smashes up genre. There's so much kind of folk and soul and rock and R&B and hip, like even notes of hip hop. If you watch their Tiny Desk concert that we recorded at NPR Music back in 2017, you just watch this person just hovering over pedals and keyboards and holding a guitar. It's just this one-person band. It's such a heady swirl of genre and music that really has this sense of hope to it.
Well, we will tweet out a link to that Tiny Desk concert at 1A. We're talking to Stephen Thompson from NPR Music and the Pop Culture Happy Hour. Also with us, Anne Hornaday, movie critic at The Washington Post, and Caroline Framke, chief TV critic at Variety. And this is Pretty Lady by Tash Sultana from their new album, Terra Firma. I'm Jen White. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR. Pretty Lady. I'm Jen White. This is 1A. We've still got lots to talk about on this month's edition of the 1A Hit List. Giving us their expert advice on what to listen to and watch are Anne Hornaday, movie critic at The Washington Post, Stephen Thompson from NPR Music and the Pop Culture Happy Hour, and Caroline Framke, chief TV critic at Variety. We also want to hear from you. What recent movies, TV shows, or documentaries have you watched and loved? Lucas wrote on Facebook, I've been doing a rewatch of Star Trek, The Next Generation. Great choice, Lucas. The focus on using diplomacy, science, and empathy to solve problems and mediate conflicts is a refreshing break from our volatile world where these principles are ignored too often. It gives me hope. Well, you can share your picks on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or send us an email at 1A@WAMU.org. The TV comedy Ted Lasso stars Jason Sudeikis as the title character. Ted is an American football coach who's hired to work for a London football team, what we in America call soccer. He's hired by the former owner's wife, who is intent on running the team into the ground.
Do you like darts, Ted?
Oh, they're okay. I'm more of a cornhole man myself. Yeah. Nope.
Yeah. How about a game? I mean, we could, you know, maybe wager, say, £10,000.
Well, as my doctor told me when I got addicted to fettuccine Alfredo, that's a little rich for my blood. How about this? If you win, I'll let you pick the starting lineup of the last two games of the season. But if I win, you can't go anywhere near the owner's box, at least not while Rebecca's still in charge.
Caroline, Ted Lasso premiered in August on Apple TV Plus, but it's gaining more and more attention. What's behind the buzz?
Well, I think that it premiered at exactly the right time. This is a show about nice people learning to be nicer and more considerate sort of every day, learning to be better men. That's something that Ted Lasso, Sudeikis' character, talks about a lot as being something that he really values as a coach, even more so than winning. So I think while I would have liked this at any time, I think, you know, however many months into the pandemic, I can't even count them right now, something like Ted Lasso really hit at the right moment. This is something that people wanted to watch. I feel like I always compare it to Schitt's Creek in that way. Mm-hmm. This is a show that really makes people feel good to watch. And I don't know about you, it's my job to watch television, but I find it really hard these days to concentrate on anything very dramatic or emotionally taxing. So Ted Lasso hit it where It felt good.
Well, Terry told us on Facebook that Ted Lasso is his absolute favorite show in forever. Cameron wrote on Facebook, "My wife and I love Ted Lasso. It has inspired us to have a positive outlook each day and to be the best versions of ourselves we can be." And Chris wrote on Facebook, "Ted Lasso is really a breath of fresh air, something positive without reservation, snark, or insincerity. I have also found the podcast Smartless to be in the same vein. Jason Bateman, Sean Hayes, and Will Arnett interview a wide variety of guests during Stay at Home, and it's a delight. It's almost like visiting with friends, or at least the closest I have to imagine for now." Stephen, what's your take on Ted Lasso?
Well, I agree with Caroline. This show came out at the exact right time. I think I've found over time that my favorite genre of television is comedies that make me cry. So I know that's kind of a recurring theme here today, but shows like The Good Place, shows like Parks and Rec, Schitt's Creek is another great example. This show is like one long mission statement about the transformative power of decency. And in that way, it just could not have come at a better time. I have recommended this show to people across the political spectrum and really gotten back universal praise for it. I recommend this show to absolutely anybody.
Caroline, how common is this that we're seeing, you know, these sleeper hits nowadays with streaming, where maybe a TV show or film doesn't get attention with when it premieres, but it gains traction later?
You know, I actually think it's not quite as common as maybe it once was, because there is so much now that, you know, a new show, four new shows drop every week on Netflix. My entire job could be reviewing Netflix shows. So the ones that do break through for a reason. Like, I think Bridgerton is another example of a show that has unusual staying power, because it also premiered at a good time and it hit a lot of cultural flashpoints that I think really work for it. But Ted Lasso has unusual staying power, I will say. I am constantly surprised by, as Stephen said, who I see watching it. I feel like a week ago I saw Barry Jenkins, the director of Moonlight, freaking out over it. You know, every week there's someone new who's into it.
And talk about Jason Sudeikis' performance in this series.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really interesting performance from him, because he's kind of been known over the years for, you know, very bro-y sort of braggadocious characters. And that's actually how Ted Lasso started. It's based on a character he created for a 2013 NBC Sports promo. When NBC Sports got the rights to the Premier League, and they wanted to advertise that to American football fans or just sports fans who might not know it. And that version of Ted Lasso was much more in sort of a Michael Scott vein, you know, where he came in and kind of didn't know what he was doing, but was going to be aggressive about it anyway. And I think that version of Ted Lasso would not have been as popular as the version that existed in 2020, the one who comes in and just wants to do a good job and, you know, likes to win. But what he likes more is to make his players feel good, to make everyone feel good, to the point that by the end of the season, without spoiling anything specific, everyone is on Ted Lasso's side. You can't help it.
Well, Stephen, it sounds like this is also sort of a fish out of water story, which can be really difficult to freshen up. Does it do that successfully?
Well, I think it does. I mean, you have lots of jokes about this guy who's kind of been plopped into the UK, and he talks about how he hates tea, and you have all these kind of running gags about how he assimilates into, you know, English life. But I also think it's one of the things that makes the show universal. I think there are elements of it that feel very novel, but it's also the comfort and familiarity of characters you like going through beats that you can easily understand that makes it a show that I can recommend to everybody, you know, just like I said, everybody across the political spectrum. I've had no trouble recommending this show to everybody, in part because of how comforting and familiar it is.
Well, let's switch gears a bit and talk about a documentary, MLK FBI. It looks at the FBI's secret campaign against Martin Luther King Jr. And tell us about your experience watching this documentary.
This is just an exquisite piece of filmmaking. It's made by Sam Pollard, who has edited a lot of Spike Lee's movies. He's a really gifted editor. And, you know, the kind of cliche is that documentaries are written in editing. It's really all about how you assemble the information that you discover and the elements, the visual elements and the aural elements and the voices that you bring together. And as an example of that, it is absolutely outstanding. It does uncover this campaign, which was alluded to in Ava DuVernay's film, Selma, but it really goes into granular detail about how J. Edgar Hoover orchestrated this campaign of surveillance and harassment against Martin Luther King and what a threat he posed. And then Pollard really pulls the lens back to look at the FBI's image in popular culture and how institutional racism and white supremacy were kind of woven through our politics and our culture. It's just one of his most brilliant choices in my mind is all of the what we would call talking heads, you know, the contemporaneous witnesses who are who participate in the film are voices. They're not talking heads. They're we hear them, but we don't see them until the end. And so he world builds, you know, he really builds an entire universe that you enter in this movie completely through the images and the sounds. It's just a gorgeous piece of filmmaking and a really compelling story.
Well, and I believe that documentary is available on Amazon Prime. That's MLK FBI. Were there any surprises for you in watching this film, Anne?
That's a really good question. You know, it's interesting. We have so many movies, which we're going to be talking about, Judas and the Black Messiah, about people who were recruited, you know, African-Americans from the community who were recruited to infiltrate movements and to infiltrate offices. And so the degree to which that was going on, I think that was a genuine revelation for me. Yeah.
We are bringing you this month's hit list, and you are sharing your recommendations. Jean wrote on Facebook, I love watching the animated series Attack on Titan on Hulu. It's best described as The Walking Dead meets Game of Thrones with man-eating giants. How have I not heard about this? This series is now in its fourth and final season, and I'm looking forward to how it ends. Wesley tweeted, WandaVision on Disney Plus has me on the edge of my seat. Same, Wesley. The intrigue that Marvel is building is keeping me coming back week after week. It's such a shame. It is a 9-episode limited series. And Julie tweeted, we've been binging Outlander. I'm rewatching with my boomer mom, who says after every episode, that was like a movie. Great historical fiction with just a touch of sci-fi, and the acting is fabulous. Keep your recommendations coming. Tweet us at 1A. Well, as you mentioned, there's another film about the FBI surveillance of a civil rights leader, and it's been getting a lot of attention, Judas and the Black Messiah. It's based on the true story of Black Panther leader Fred Hampton, played by Daniel Kaluuya.
Ain't that a trip? We paid in, huh? We paid the pig to run us off of our corners. Let me ask y'all something. If this building caught fire right now, what would y'all worry about, huh? Water and escape. If somebody would ask you, what's your culture during this fire, brother? Water. That's my culture. Well, how about your politics? Water and escape. Well, guess what? America's on fire right now. And until that fire's extinguished, don't nothing else mean a goddamn thing.
A Judas and the Black Messiah is streaming on HBO Plus. Stephen, what did you think of the movie?
Well, I think this movie centers on two fantastic performances. You just heard Daniel Kaluuya, the star of Get Out, among many other films. He has the most effectively steely, roving gaze in all of the movies. He plays Fred Hampton, the Black Panther leader, and Lakeith Stanfield plays, as you mentioned, an informant. And Lakeith Stanfield manages to invest that character with a lot of kind of opaque, kind of unknowability. I just found this movie worked really well with these performances and kind of capturing the complexity and contradictions within a movement that was actually a lot of competing and sometimes contradictory movements. I think less effective is where you get like Martin Sheen in pancake makeup as J. Edgar Hoover. I don't think that worked nearly as well, but I still found the movie to be powerful in part because of those central performances.
I'm Jen White. You're listening to 1A. We're talking to Stephen Thompson from NPR Music and the Pop Culture Happy Hour, Caroline Framke, Chief TV Critic at Variety, and Anne Hornaday, Movie Critic at The Washington Post. Anne, what did you think of the film?
I was really impressed with it, largely because of those performances that Stephen just highlighted, but just the filmmaking itself. This was co-written and directed by Shaka King, and it really recalls those tough, taut urban city thrillers, you know, that I feel like I came of age with in the 70s, just really lean, good, effective storytelling. It's been shot by a cinematographer named Sean Bobbitt, who often works with Steve McQueen, the British filmmaker, artist and filmmaker, and it just looks, it looks fantastic, and it moves, and it sounds great. You know, it's just, it's the whole package. So yes, it tells this incredibly important and, as Stephen said, contradictory story that's full of fascinating ambiguities, but it's also really entertaining. You know, it works as a thriller. It's just, it's a great kind of cat and mouse psychological thriller. And I really appreciated it on that level too, just the craft of it.
I was also impressed by these moments of tenderness in the film. You get to explore a romantic relationship and these friendships. I thought that was particularly effective as well. Director Shaka King said in an interview that he played the song The Inflated Tear by Roland Kirk in the pitch meetings for Judas and the Black Messiah. And King said it's what the movie feels like. The director recruited his uncle, a Harlem jazz musician, to compose the score for Judas and the Black Messiah. Stephen, talk about the role music plays in setting the mood for this film.
Well, I think you just said it well. I mean, he's using a lot of period music to really give a sense of electricity and movement to the scenes in the film. And as Anne said, it does unfold like a thriller. And so much of that comes out of its deployment of music. I did find, like, right at the end of the film, over the closing credits, they play a song by her called Fight For You. And it's nominated for a Golden Globe this weekend. And, you know, I was kind of going over all the songs that are nominated for Golden Globes, the songs that are shortlisted for the Oscar. And that's where I actually get frustrated, because these closing credits songs feel so similar to each other. I was listening to like a dozen songs that are shortlisted for the Oscars, and they all just kind of blur together into like, I will speak and raise my voice to rise and stand and fight, because it's all songs with like those same five words in them. But while the movie is going on, he's using so much period music to tremendous effect.
And what about for you, Anne? Because we're seeing more of these companion albums being released for film. Is that something we should expect going forward? Because this one has a companion album that has 22 original songs. Her, A$AP Rocky, Nas, Jay-Z, the late Nipsey Hussle. Is this a growing trend?
I believe it is. I just think that, and this, it's not new. You know, since the days of Grease and Saturday Night Fever, and you know, the soundtrack album has always been a key part of marketing. It's been a key part of revenue, and the Inspired By is maybe a little bit on the newer side. That because that's the Inspired By album, and I'm so old that when we were talking about the soundtrack album, I was thinking of the actual soundtrack album, and listening to that incredible score, which is a really strong piece of music, I think, in its own right. It's very percussive and dissonant, and does kind of capture and propel that mood. But, you know, these are all just ways to kind of heighten in this great onrush of visual storytelling that we're all faced with now. It's just one more way to kind of find some distinction and create a little bit of extra awareness for a project.
Well, this is the song Fight For You by Her from Judas and the Black Messiah. You're listening to it now. I just want to make sure to call out the performance by Dominique Fishback in this film. She plays Deborah Johnson, and I thought her performance was just stunning. Today's 1A Hit List stars are Stephen Thompson from NPR Music and the Pop Culture Happy Hour. Also with us, Anne Hornaday, movie critic at The Washington Post, and Caroline Framke, chief TV critic at Variety. And we also want to hear from you. What are you watching right now? Danny tweeted, the original Muppet Show was just released on Disney Plus, and talk about timeless, a level of writing, heart, and charm that's rarely matched even today. Share your recommendations with us. Tweet us at 1A, drop a message on our Facebook page, or email us at 1A@wamu.org. We'll hear more from you and our guests in just a moment. Now let's get back to this month's edition of the 1A Hit List. We're getting recommendations from Anne Hornaday, movie critic at The Washington Post, Caroline Framke, TV critic at Variety, and Stephen Thompson, who covers music and pop culture for NPR. I want to get into some music in just a moment, but first, I want to circle back to that Muppet Show being released on Disney Plus. And I'm curious, have any of you all thought about, you know, reaching back to your childhoods a bit, Caroline?
Oh, of course. I mean, I was so disappointed when The Muppet Show wasn't available on Disney Plus when the service first launched. So I'm really glad that they got whatever they needed to get together to get that online, because I think it's just, it's such a good television artifact, and it's TV history, and the people who are on it, I just think there's so much in that show that it would be a shame to lose to sort of the streaming black hole that can happen when you don't have streaming rights for a certain show.
Well, let's get into some new music. This is 20-year-old London singer Arlo Parks with her new song, Eugene.
I had a dream, we kissed, and it was all amethyst. The under part of your eyes was violet. You hung a cigarette between your purple lips. We've been best buds since 13.
So that's Eugene from Arlo Parks' debut album, Collapsed in Sunbeams. She says she was a poet before she became a musician. Stephen, what do you find unique about her sound?
Well, it's funny. We've been talking throughout this hour about entertainment that works especially well in pandemic times. And I think this album, Collapsed in Sunbeams, works especially well in pandemic times. It's lilting and lush and comforting and soft. And her songs are wearily hopeful. A lot of messages woven through this album about embracing pain as part of survival, about coming of age and owning your feelings. There's a song on this record called Hurt, where the chorus includes the line, "Won't hurt so much forever." And there's a lot of comfort and reassurance on this record. And she has such a distinct and soft and approachable voice. She's a major, major discovery this year. And across NPR Music, we are very excited about her.
Well, I think a show people are finding a lot of comfort in can take us out of our homes, at least virtually, into Italy. And our guide is the actor Stanley Tucci. And here's a moment from his new CNN show, Stanley Tucci Searching for Italy.
Napoli is a truly thrilling city. The second you arrive, you're engulfed by a magnificent chaos. And there's no point in fighting it. People here do things their own way.
Caroline, what made you fall in love with this show?
Well, I've been watching a lot of food travel shows in quarantine, which is maybe masochistic, but that's what I'm doing.
Same.
Right? I mean, there's just something about them. You know, I've been watching Padma Lakshmi's show on Hulu, Sameen Nosrat's show again on Netflix, and old Bourdain episodes. I find a lot of comfort in that. And Stanley Tucci in Italy, I was like, well, what's not to like? Stanley Tucci, incredibly charming actor, of course, and also an Italian man who loves to eat and has written a couple great cookbooks. There's one, the Tucci cookbook. My roommate's been cooking through it in quarantine, which has been a delight for me. And as a travel host, he is just as charming as he is in the movies. And it's going to be 6 episodes going to different cities in Italy, which I really like because, you know, it's really hard to capture an entire country in just 1 hour. And even so, having episodes devoted to just one city really gives him time to dig into stuff and try a lot of food that maybe he wouldn't have had time to do if he had to do all of Italy in just an hour.
Stephen, what was your take?
Well, I think it fits into this larger theme of kind of virtual tourism and comfort. I mean, you're touring Italy with this guy that you like, who you find is a comforting presence. You know, I, kind of like Caroline, I've been doing a lot of that sort of virtual touring, a lot of Great British Baking Show, a lot of Nadia Bakes, with the wonderfully charming Nadia Hussein, kind of leading you softly through, you know, different cooking adventures. So, you know, I definitely like these kind of limited series that provide these virtual travelogues where you know you're in good company. I mean, I think Anthony Bourdain is a perfect example of that as well. And so again, that the Stanley Tucci show kind of comes in at the perfect time, even though we feel these pangs of absence, knowing that we can't immediately follow in there.
Well, Caroline, I would imagine the pandemic had to make filming somewhat challenging for this. What do we know about that?
Well, it's interesting. They filmed 4 episodes in 2019, pre-pandemic, and then 2 apparently sort of last summer during a relative lull, I guess is how they put it. So it's kind of strange. The first episode starts in Naples and on the Amalfi Coast, and that one was filmed last summer. So there are masks and references to the pandemic. But honestly, for me, not quite enough. You know, Italy was hit so hard during the pandemic in the spring that it felt kind of strange to me to go during the summer and kind of do what it felt like they might have done any other year. I felt like maybe they should have addressed that more thoroughly. But the next episode, the second episode, is in Rome. That was filmed in 2019. And that episode, I think, is fantastic and should have kicked off the show in the first place. Especially as he goes to try all the different, there's 4 specific pastas, including, you know, cacio e pepe, carbonara, trying to get to the roots of those. And he talks to people about using quote-unquote poor ingredients like offal and artichokes, which used to just be sort of tossed to the Jewish community in Rome. So there's a lot that they can do. I'm looking forward to the second episode that was filmed amid pandemic. I don't know which one it is off the top of my head, but it is interesting to sort of see the contrast.
Well, let's turn back to another film. This is Nomadland. It's about travel of a different sort. It premiered on demand Friday, and it stars Frances McDormand. She plays a woman who finds herself short on options and becomes a part of a community of nomads who travel the country in vans.
Beau never knew his parents, and we never had kids. If I didn't stay, if I left, it would be like he never existed. I couldn't pack up and move on. He loved Empire. He loved his work so much. He loved being there. Everybody loved him. So I stayed. Same town, same house. It's like my dad used to say, what's remembered lives. I maybe spent too much of my life just remembering Bob. You know what I mean?
Now, we got this email from Etsy who says, I'm struggling to understand the excitement around Nomadland. It is possible to travel freely in and throughout numerous countries, many of which have social networks that don't force older people into such a hard life. What's so great about the life displayed in Nomadland? And, I mean, help us better understand this film and the basis of it, because it's very reflective, but it's also sobering.
Mm-hmm. It's based on a nonfiction book of the same title by Jessica Bruder, who wrote about this emerging or emergent class of migrant laborers in who pursue seasonal work in their own vehicles. They work at Amazon fulfillment centers and farms and recreational areas, and they have become a kind of permanent fixture of this late capitalist American economy. And they, you know, especially Amazon has completely, you know, created a business plan around that labor force. And I think to the listener's point of view, Etsy's point of view, what I think is the strength of this movie is that it doesn't really portray this as some kind of aspirational ideal. But nor does it portray it with pity or condescension. It just presents it. And I think Frances McDormand's protagonist, and then a lot of these non-professional, real-life nomads who are her supporting characters, really personify that kind of determination and grit, but they're not romanticized. And some of them are there by choice. Some of them aren't. And it gives space to all of that. And I think that's the kind of honesty that I appreciated about the tone of the piece, as well as just an absolutely magnificent performance on the part of McDormand, and again a visual language from the director Chloe Zha that it kind of reinvents the American Western for this new 21st century reality.
I'm Jen White. You're listening to 1A. We're talking to Anne Hornaday from The Washington Post, Caroline Framke from Variety, and Stephen Thompson from NPR. Stephen, what did you think of Nomadland?
Well, I agree completely with Anne. I found this movie to be just exquisite, and it's so carefully balanced. I didn't feel at all that it glorified, or romanticized this lifestyle, and at the same time, it didn't wallow in condescension or pity either. I think that as wonderful as the performance by Frances McDormand is at the center of this film, it also hinges on a couple of very key scenes involving non-professional actors, specifically one involving Bob Wells and one involving a woman named Swanky, who give these monologues that are absolutely gutting and beautiful. And, you know, the fact that they managed to hold their own next to one of the best performances of Frances McDormand's career is really saying something. This is such a carefully and painstakingly and beautifully edited film. You can just imagine how much footage Chloe Zhao collected in the filming of this movie and managed to weave it together into something that is appropriately meandering and yet never gets boring, at least in my eyes. I love this film. This is probably my favorite movie of the year.
Well, and Nomadland director Chloe Zhao is up for a Golden Globe for her work on the movie. Is one of three women nominees, and is this the first time more than one woman has been nominated in the same year? Talk about the work she did on the film.
Well, you know, it's interesting. She came to my attention with a movie she did a few years ago called The Rider, which has a lot of similar elements. With that one, too, she used mostly non-professional actors. And it was a fact-based story that she sort of wove around a central character. And like this one, takes place mostly in the American West. And so she has this, she just has a really keen eye for landscape and for humans within that landscape. And like what Stephen alluded to, and I've been talking about, that tonal, this kind of humanism that just pervades her work, where she gives people their dignity without that kind of falseness that I think can often, you know, I even avoid using the word dignity because so often that is a condescending term, but she just gives them their personhood and a monumentality, you know, against that kind of classic John Ford monument, you know, triumphalist backdrop. I just feel like she's at once elaborating on that visual language, but then kind of subverting it at the same time by her choices of who she centers in the narrative and then who she chooses to play them. I just think she's just a huge directorial talent in terms of her choices, her eye, her sophistication about how you marry the image and sound to create a narrative.
Well, we'll have to keep watching and see if she takes home the prize this weekend. Caroline, what TV shows are you kind of crossing your fingers for during the Golden Globes this weekend?
Well, before I answer that, a caveat that my favorite TV show of last year, Michaela Cole's I May Destroy You, wasn't nominated for anything,
right?
Which is a huge disappointment. And, you know, the other caveat being the Hollywood Foreign Press is a relatively small voting body, and the TV nominations are always kind of all over the place. So with that in mind, and knowing that I May Destroy You was snubbed, and that the TV nominations are overwhelmingly white, so many caveats, I suppose. Of all that said, I really like what Kaylee Cuoco is doing on The Flight Attendant. That's HBO Max's sort of first original that really popped, I think. Anya Taylor-Joy for The Queen's Gambit. I think that show wouldn't have worked half as well without someone that magnetic at the center of it. And I also got to say that while I think The Crown is overrepresented, as is Netflix in general, that I think Olivia Colman's performance as Queen Elizabeth, which this was her last season in that role, is generally underrated, I think. She hasn't had quite as much to do as maybe Claire Foy did in the first two seasons, but her background as a comedian, I think, gives the show some really necessary comic timing and the moments when she gets to sort of explode at someone she finds irritating, like Gillian Anderson's Thatcher or Josh O'Connor's Charles, are so good.
Well, one last thing before we go. The groundbreaking electronic music duo Daft Punk released a video that showed the helmet-clad duo walking away from each other in a desert. The message? Their retirement. Stephen, how influential was this group?
Well, I think they were extraordinarily influential. I mean, they only made four official studio albums in 28 years, but the last one, Random Access Memories, won Album and Record of the Year at the Grammys, and they worked with artists like The Weeknd and Kanye West and Pharrell in ways that you just feel in a lot of pop music that's out today. I mean, just The Weeknd, who has been such a dominant presence, clearly drew a lot of inspiration from Daft Punk. And so I think, I think the commitment to quality control and the ability to fuse kind of computerized sounds with very, very organic house and pop and funk and disco music gave them a sound that A, will be missed, but B, will continue to reverberate throughout pop music for a long time to come.
That's Stephen Thompson, an editor and producer for NPR Music and host of the Pop Culture Happy Hour. And Hornaday was also with us, movie critic at The Washington Post, and Caroline Framke, chief TV critic at Variety. Thanks to you all. We'll wrap on this recommendation from Todd, who tweets, a great sleeper hit is For All Mankind on Apple TV. Fascinating and interesting series. Today's producer was Avery Kleinman. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow. This is 1A.